Okay. Sure.
But, you know, that's just, I don't know.
So you had a question about something?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the te igitur of the Mass. And when I was speaking with your brother the other night about this, and you know what prayer I'm speaking about, you know, that when the priest prays for the church and the ecclesiastical authorities.
Right.
When he prays and he prays for the bishop and when he prays for Benedict the 16th at that point, I was telling your brother the other night that I feel and I felt that at that second, that completely it becomes a sacrilege, that Mass.
Yeah, I don't agree with that at all.
And I don't know. I mean, I don't know where there may be something that...
Well, let me ask you this.
Shed light on it to me, explain maybe to me, because I don't know.
Okay.
So, why,
well, let me ask you this. Would you say that Padre Pio's Mass was sacrilegious?
See, that's a good question, because that's what your brother asked me the other night, and I didn't... And my answer to that was, my answer was yes, that's what I told him. I said that sacrifice, the sacrifice at that time was not pleasing or acceptable to God.
Yeah, and see, the reason that's wrong and the reason why arguments that all masses where Benedict XVI is named as the Pope are necessarily off-limits fail is because the prayer mentioning Benedict XVI in the Mass is an accidental part of the Mass. In other words, the primary purpose of the Mass is not to pray for Benedict XVI. I would agree that if you were meeting, okay, or if you were going to this church simply to pray for Benedict XVI as the Pope, that would be absolutely off limits, and that would be a compromise to show up for that. But the purpose of that particular service or liturgy is to offer the Mass. The prayer for the ecclesiastical authorities or the people they think are the ecclesiastical authorities is an accidental part of that. And what's interesting is that a lot of people, certain people make the argument that, well, you can't go there because that particular prayer has a major historical significance in showing communion with the man who's being prayed for. And here's, you see what I'm saying? Here's the,
oh, yeah,
that's
absolutely
what they argue.
Well, that's what my thinking was on the subject. That's why the question is brought about.
Okay, the problem with that argument is a failure to recognize that the historical significance of that prayer for the man who, you know, claims to be the Bishop of Rome or the person they're including as the Bishop of Rome is not to show, first and foremost, communion with that person. It's to show communion with the papacy. And that's proven by the fact that in different ages of church history, the prayer would remain the same, but you would just insert a different person's name into the prayer. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, because there may be a different bishop of that diet, of the bishop
yeah,
that priest is praying.
Or a different pope.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
So the point here is that the person mentioned is accidental. Okay, it's important. Okay, but the main purpose of the prayer is to pray in communion with the office of the papacy. You see the difference? Okay. And so that's a key point in understanding this. It's something where that prayer remains the same. They just insert the person they believe to be the Pope in it. And so it's not primarily a prayer, first and foremost, for Benedict XVI, as it is a prayer to show communion with the chair of Rome. And so for that reason, the signification of it is simply to show communion with the papacy, even though they are in fact dead wrong about who they think the Pope is. And so like some people have said, that's equivalent to go to a Mass where he's mentioned as the Pope is equivalent to burning a little bit of incense to idols. That is completely absurd, totally ridiculous, okay? Because the purpose of the Mass and the purpose of the liturgy you're showing up for is the Mass. Would they say that you could go if, let's say, Benedict XVI died and they weren't naming him? No. Okay, so the fundamental reason why you're going or not going is not whether he's named. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Yeah, and so that's a minor part. It's not the main purpose of the service. Okay, and the very main purpose of the prayer is not for Benedict XVI. It is actually for to try to show communion with the chair of Rome, and that's why the prayer would remain the same, but the different names would be inserted. And so I think in understanding those two points, that that it's not the main purpose of the Mass, they like to, you know, really exaggerate this and basically say that it's basically a Mass all about Benedict XVI, which is a grave exaggeration. Distortion.
Oh, absolutely. That's not. I would never ever say that that's what that is for.
Well, that's the impression that they give. That basically,
well,
since
you go to
mentioned
Norvus Ordo Mass, I guess if you're in a Norvus Ordo Mass now, you would think that. I could see. So people related, you know what I mean? That you could fall into that trap.
Uh huh.
Wouldn't you think? I mean, with the way the Norvus Ordo Church is. I mean, you know, that's definitely a sacrilege. There's no question about it.
Oh, the new Mass?
Mass.
Yeah.
It changed all the prayers.
Right.
It changed everything around. That's a sacrilege. And, of course, maybe people in that church would feel that the Mass is being prayed for Benedict XVI. I don't know. That wouldn't surprise me, you know, because it's people-orientated, right?
Here's an interesting quote, which, and there's another interesting point we just came across, which further proves that our position on where people can go is Catholic, while the position of those who say it's heretical is completely wrong. It's interesting that Pope Galatius, who is a 5th century pope, and I have a quote here, it's pretty interesting, like the prayers in the early church, which were the equivalent of like the Te Igitur, were they were a part of the Mass. And you would put the name of the patriarch or the name of the bishop of Rome in the diptychs. That's what it was called, where you would commemorate the bishop or commemorate the bishop of Rome.
Okay.
And this is an interesting quote. I just want to look at this here. Hold on a sec.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a quote about how you had a schismatic bishop, a Cacaeus, from Constantinople, and it says that, this is page 211 of the History of the Councils, the Pope made every effort to urge the Latin-speaking bishops of Illyria to erase the hated name of a Cacaeus from their diptychs. So he's urging them to remove this guy so that they don't, like, pray in communion with him.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not aware of any, you know, decree that says that, you know, if they don't, every single person who's going to church in Constantinople has to stop going. You see what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, right.
Okay, but that would be the equivalent of what schismatics would have to say. You see what I'm saying? That if he didn't decree that, he would be sinning mortally, according to them. He would be allowing heresy to flourish. You see what I'm saying? They didn't look at this the way that the people who are making this argument did. Here's another point, that during the Great Western Schism, during the Anglican Schism, when Henry VIII, and then you had Edward VI, and Elizabeth, the schismatic queen, she basically imposed that there was this new Mass imposed, and then she started to enforce attendance at it. You know, she would fine people for not, you know, being present at the Protestant services. Okay, you know, some heavy fines, and it would really make life miserable. And in one of our articles, which deals with this whole issue, we quoted a priest who was commenting on this period. And I just want to get this, if you can wait a second.
Yeah, that's not a problem, because it's funny you say that, because just the other night I was watching, I think it was Saturday night, it was on the History Channel. They had the history of the Protestant Reformation, and it was 2 hours long, and it started with Martin Luther, and I've watched it, and it was just so educational, to a sense, to understand where the world is right now because of one man.
Yeah.
Because of one person, how this world is the way it is today, how he could take the fact that a person is justified simply because they believe in Jesus Christ, and they can basically, you know, do whatever they want to do, in other words, rebel against the church, which is, in essence, is just meaning putting man above God. That's the way I look at it. That's man above God when you rebel against the church. You just say, well, okay, I don't need to do this, that, or the other, but I still believe in God. That's, you know, kind of similar to Satan, right? And isn't that what he did? Isn't that what he did, his sin?
Well, yeah.
I'll ascend above God.
Well, when you really analyze it, all the founders of their own sects are false Christs, because only Christ can found a church. So they arrogate to themselves authority that only Christ had. And it's pretty interesting, because even like certain schismatics among the radical traditionalists, you can see this false Christ mentality in them, whether they realize it or not. Some of the things they say, like their writings are by the precious blood of Christ and things like that. And so it's something where you can see how they've become little false Christs. And but that's what happens with every person who founds his own church, whether it's Luther, Calvin, etc. But she imposed this.
That's
new...
where I got the history, by the way. I wanted to tell you. That's how I know what you're talking about from just watching this the other night. I would have probably never knew what you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But they went through the period of, you know, Henry VIII and Elizabeth and all that, so I can kind of be on the same page as what you're going to tell me now a little bit, you know?
Okay. Well, you had a situation when this new mass was being imposed and people were resisting it. You had a similar situation to what we have today, where you have people who resisted it, some people who gave in, some people who didn't go. Okay, you had priests who were, you know, compromising themselves, but also trying to administer the traditional sacrament to people who wanted it. Okay, so you had like an indult situation in a lot of cases. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Okay, so I quoted in this article I wrote on the question of whether you can go to some of these masses. I quoted a passage from this book, The Rise and Growth of the Anglican Schism, page 267. And this concerns this kind of situation. And this was by a priest named Father Richton, who was a missionary priest at that time. Well, he was describing a situation, I'll quote, because it gives some background to the point I want to make. He says, "What is still more marvelous and more sad, sometimes the priest saying Mass at home, for the sake of those Catholics whom he knew to be desirous of them, carried about him hosts consecrated according to the rite of the Church, with which he communicated them at the very time in which he was giving to other Catholics more careless about the faith the bread prepared for them according to the heretical rite." Okay, you can see the quote in that file, but you see what I'm saying? He's saying that there were Catholics who wanted the traditional hosts, and this priest was communicating them with the traditional hosts. Meanwhile, in his ministrations, he would also give people who were more compromising the invalid bread prepared according to the heretical rite. Okay, my point is this, that from this quote, it's very obvious that this Father Richton did not consider those people who were receiving the communion in the traditional rite from the priest himself who was compromising himself and giving it to both and had compromised with the heretical queen. He did not consider those people, it's obvious, as manifest heretics or schismatics or apostates. He calls both groups Catholics. This is a very conservative priest from the 16th century. He was actually captured with Blessed Edmund Campion, okay? And so he says that these priests were carrying these hosts for the sake of Catholics whom he knew to be desirous of them and giving them communion. At the same time, he was giving these more compromising people the bread prepared for them according to the heretical rite. My point is this, he did not look at this the way that these radical schismatics who say you can't go anywhere look at it. He was obviously not condemning that group as heretical. Now, some people have tried to argue otherwise, but it's clearly ridiculous. And what further proves our position on... Do you follow what I'm saying, or do you need me to...
Oh, yeah, no, I'm getting you.
Okay.
I'm following along with you.
All right, and if people want to look at that file, they can see the quote in print, which helps them understand this, but recently I was rereading the book on Pope St. Pius V. It's a little book, and there's another thing on Pope St. Pius V, which is much more extensive. But it's fascinating because it really confirms our interpretation and our understanding of this issue. which is this, that Pope St. Pius V, prior to becoming Pope, as Cardinal Inquisitor, this is quoting from the book, page 45, Pope St. Pius V, when Cardinal Inquisitor, Pius had granted certain English priests faculties for readmitting schismatics into the Catholic Church, the only condition then having been to refrain from reception of the Protestant Eucharist. You see that?
Oh, yeah.
So he was, Pius V was basically legislating on what, when people convert, what abjuration do they have to make, or what do they have to profess to? What do they have to agree to? Do they have to agree to never, ever receive a sacrament from a priest who's compromised themselves? No. He says that they have to refrain from receiving the Protestant Eucharist. In other words, receiving the invalid host. Now, what's interesting is, he goes on to say, in 1567, as Pope, he made the further more rigorous condition of non-attendance at Protestant services. Isn't that it? So he increased it. Now, someone will say, wait a second, was he leaving it open for attendance at Protestant services before that?
Yeah, that's what that, you could interpret
Here's the thing.
He followed it up and said no afterwards.
Well, here's the difference, that the Queen was imposing being present at Protestant services under pain of heavy fines, okay? So there was actually a debate among certain people as to whether, in other words, like let's say someone had a gun to your head and said, unless you're, you know, you compromise and, or unless you come with me, I'm going to blow your head off. At what point would you have to say, blow my head off? Obviously, if he told you you have to worship a false god or deny an article of faith, but what, could you go into the building and just stand there? Okay? I would say no. My opinion would be no. You could not go into the building. But some people said, well, you're not participating in that. Okay, this is sort of like passive attendance, and we can get into this about how it's not comparable to what people consider passive attendance today. But you see what I'm saying? Certain theologians were on both sides of this issue at the time. They were debating it, whether if you're bound under pain of heavy burden, where's the absolute line drawn? It's obviously drawn, you can never receive the invalid host. But if it's just like showing up at a building, do you have to not even step in the door, okay, and therefore, you know, face the heavy fines? My opinion would have been yes, okay, but some people debated that. So Pius V, as Cardinal Inquisitor, obviously probably due to the confusion on this issue or some of the divergent opinions, he said he didn't make that a requirement, okay, but later on as Pope he did. You see what I'm saying? But it shows how differently they looked at it from what we are. But what it absolutely shows is that he never made it a requirement that you could never receive a sacrament from a priest himself who was implicated with the heretics. You see the point?
Well, you know what this actually proves even more now to me? It proves what we were talking about yesterday about dogmatic laws and ecclesiastical laws.
Right.
It even proves that point more.
That's right.
You know what I mean? That's my opinion. That's what I take out of it.
That necessity...
You're proving another point, too, and not even realizing it.
That necessity makes licit that which is illicit unless the faith is compromised. Okay? And so you can do things in necessity that you normally would not do because the salvation of souls is the supreme law. And so these... But I find this particularly devastating to the schismatics who say that our position is heretical, the few who do. This totally proves it wrong. They would have to say that Pius V was sinning mortally by omission and basically giving favor to heresy by not legislating that you could never receive sacraments from basically any priest in the realm, which he never did. Okay, and so it shows you how different his view on it. Now, one thing I want to point out is, some people would say, well, that seems to favor passive attendance, which we've pointed out, like people during the late 1800s and early 1900s, this idea that you could passively attend non-Catholic services has been promoted.
In other words, I could go to a Baptist church as long as I don't participate in it, or something.
Yeah, for a friend's wedding or for some reason.
Yeah, right. Okay. That's okay.
And we were totally opposed to that. We've been quite outspoken on that because we believe that's a compromise. Now, some people might say, well, what you're saying about what was legislated when Pius V was Cardinal Inquisitor, seems to favor that passive attendance is okay. And I would say, no, it's not comparable to what you're saying passive attendance is, because in this case, the debate surrounded the issue of whether you were bound to avoid it, because there were heavy fines and sanctions and great, great hardships involved.
Right. People don't know. Most people don't know, and I didn't know, quite frankly, until last week when I watched the show about it. You have to understand what was going on at that time. Here is a queen that is forcing every single person in England. They're trying to bring the Protestant church back. They want everybody to be a Protestant, which was Catholic. So when you look at that situation there, that's a whole different situation.
Exactly.
Now, nobody's forcing anybody. That's because we live in this liberal, free-thinking, modernistic world where everybody can do whatever they want to do. That's the problem. Wouldn't you agree?
That's right.
I mean, everybody can do whatever they want. You can do whatever you think. Do you think your purse makes you feel good? So at that time, the Queen, like you said, was enforcing heavy fines on people. You must be Protestant or this or that. So
yeah. So for people,
points there.
So for people to say that, well, because there was some confusion as to whether people could be present at the Protestant services without sin, maybe some level of debate on that issue, that proves that I can go to my Baptist friend's wedding. No, sorry. Those two situations are not comparable, and we believe it is definitely a compromise to go to those non-Catholic funerals or weddings or services passively. And so, but I think this really devastates, because Pius V, and actually I wanted to do a little audio thing on Pius V, just an incredible pope. I mean, how rigorous he was in so many areas, and the things he would do, the laws he enacted against sodomites, adulterers. It was just, talk about a Catholic pope. And he himself, okay, is saying something that's perfectly in line with our position on this issue, and which these people who say it's heretical to even think you could go to one of these churches, they would have to say he's sinning mortally, at least by omission. And clearly, if you examine what he legislated in the context of what was going on, it clearly proves that he looked at it the same way we did. And it really proves completely wrong these people who said that our interpretation of this quote from Rishton, which I found, about how he's commenting on some people are receiving communion from these priests who are giving it to both parties, they're saying, well, he's not endorsing that. He clearly was not condemning those people who did that. So it really just proves how these schismatics are not Catholics, and how our position is correct and balanced. Not that you have to go, but that in a necessity, in a crisis, in a unique period, that things can be done which, you know, normally would not be.
Sure, sure.
So, but you were saying that when you saw the law, because you had asked about jurisdiction and some people had been, you know, confused about that, that when you saw that, for instance, the law in the past that monks were required to go to confession once a month, and that obviously that law is not binding any longer, or in this situation, that really showed to you the difference between some of these matters.
Well, yeah, very, absolutely. I mean, it was almost kind of like, what's the old saying? You, there's two things you can't teach a person, that's desire or common sense. Well, it was like common sense hit me right in the square in the eye, because I didn't know anything about it. So, you know, common sense leads to that. If that was the case, then you would be in big trouble today.
Yeah, exactly.
You'd be in big, big trouble, because you would be forced by, if you want to say, the people that want to argue that there's no jurisdiction for any priest right now on the planet, that you would argue that you're in mortal sin then, because then you're breaking a law that you must go to confession.
Exactly.
Once a month. I mean, and that, of course, that was for monks back then, but we have to also understand at that time that monks were really only people that really were literate. They knew how to read, and they were, you know, they were religious. So, yeah, that's very, very, very profound to understand that ecclesia. In other words, I understand the difference between dogmatic law now and ecclesiastical law, and won't be able to confuse them and, you know, say that an ecclesiastical law is a dogma. It's not.
That's right.
Not. I didn't understand that before, but that example and the example of using your crossbow
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that there's another example. I mean,
there's thousands.
There's probably thousands of them that you can use. One of them would be a good example of what Pope Pius V had there, is that, you know, as far as your attendance, if you were in a Protestant church or something at that time, but you weren't participating or doing anything because you were forced to be in there, would not constitute you to be sinning.
Well, yeah, he didn't necessarily explicitly address that, but his legislation as Cardinal Inquisitor simply said that you had to refrain from the Protestant Eucharist, and the reason it didn't say you must refrain from all attendance at Protestant services until he later became Pope was because there was some level of debate about that particular issue. And so what it really shows is, like, there's a small number of radical schismatics out there who say that it's a mortal sin of omission and basically a failure to profess the faith to not get people, okay, when converting them today, to promise and profess that they'll never attend a mass of, you know, in union with Benedict XVI, or that they recognize all the people who go to the masses where Benedict XVI is named as non-Catholics. They say that unless you do this, you know, failing to profess the faith, or it's an inadequate abjuration, or whatever they say, well, this proves them completely wrong, because Pope St. Pius V, in a situation which in many ways is comparable to our own, did not legislate any such thing for the readmittance of schismatics into the Church who had been compromised with heresies of this nature and false services of this nature. He simply said you must refrain from the Protestant Eucharist, and then as Pope, you must refrain from the Protestant Eucharist and attendance at Protestant services, which is exactly what we say. We say that you cannot go to the new Mass before you receive communion. You must obviously hold all the other teachings of the Church and not compromise them. But other than that, one doesn't have to make a positive statement about whether everyone at this particular church is lost and so forth.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. That is completely clear as a whistle. And then also to follow up on your question, you asked me about the, the jurisdictional part. Is I didn't really have any understanding of what ordinary jurisdiction compared to delegated jurisdiction meant. That which now I do understand, because I mean, it's for the simple fact is that if in a time of necessity or dire emergency, which would be death,
right,
a priest at any given time can give you the last rites. That in itself is profound.
Well, yeah, as we were talking about yesterday, this position that none of these priests have jurisdiction is, I have to say, about as stupid as traditionalist errors get. I mean, it demonstrates such a failure to consider the history of the Church, all of the different things which don't line up with this position. It's really ridiculous. And so for those people, especially who have the chance to see their error pointed out to them, it really is ridiculous. And so it's something where that's why, like, even some of these people, we've made this information available to them, and they still assert the position. And you point out to them, like, the Code of Canon Law says that any priest in danger of death is granted jurisdiction automatically for confessions. Well, how does he get it? He gets it automatically. That proves that the way that jurisdiction is given, okay, is a matter of ecclesiastical law, and that the Church can supply it automatically. So,
absolutely. And if we don't, I guess it would be a fair statement, wouldn't you say, that if we're not in a state of emergency now in the Catholic Church, well, I mean, I don't know what other state of emergency we could be in.
Oh, well, yeah, this is the gravest crisis in all of history.
Ever, yeah, ever.
And that's why so many of these statements which people cite, even with regard to, where to receive sacraments, are taken from periods which never envisioned this kind of scenario. They were talking about non-Catholic Protestant churches. Okay, they never envisioned a situation where the Catholic buildings would be taken over, in addition, okay, to the man in Rome, for decades and decades, and basically the whole apparent hierarchy, alleging to be Catholic, but in fact was a pseudo-hierarchy, It's totally unique from that standpoint.
You just wonder what kind of ecclesiastical laws would have been put into place for something along those lines, you know what I mean? But we'll never know, but it would just be curious, you know?
Well, yeah. And see, that's why people have to understand how, you know, our Lord looks at these things. I mean, like in the Gospels, like when the Pharisees denounced the apostles for picking corn on the Sabbath, and he said, you know, did you not see what David did when he was on the run from King Saul? When he was on the run, he went in and ate the loaves of proposition, which were forbidden to eat. He could not eat them, but he was on the run, and he was hungry, and he needed to do it. And so he ate them. Necessity made licit that which is illicit. And so that's how our Lord looks at these things. It's something where he values the most important things. The ecclesiastical laws are geared toward everything else. And so if they come to hinder that, then they're defeating their purpose. And so the faith is paramount. That can never be compromised. But it's not, okay, in approaching a priest whom you're not showing any agreement with, okay, even if he himself has compromised himself. So
yeah, and, you know, when I asked you about the, you know, the Te Igitur earlier, you know, it was basically my gathering on that was is that it would, in turn, make the offering to God a sacrilege by praying for a notorious heretic. I don't know of anybody else other than you know, John Paul II that could be any more bigger of a heretic. I don't think Benedict XVI will ever be able to live long enough to be able to top that.
But, well, there's some interesting points about that.
He's 81 years old, but I mean, I don't know that he could actually top that. Because he probably won't be able to, because the seed had grown already. You know what I mean? John Paul II had reached so many people, and, you know, preached the man-god doctrine, that, and so many people bought into it because that's what they want to do.
Well,
you know.
From
but so I don't really know, but that's what my concern was just about that prayer. And if you went to a church and a priest used that prayer and used, you know, Benedict XVI and included him in the prayer, would that offering to God the Father, the sacrifice of the Mass, be a displeasing offering? Would that be an offering that's not acceptable
well,
to God?
On the part of the person offering it, he would be displeasing because he personally is not in a good state before God. But in itself, I would say no, because again, that's an accidental part of the Mass. The Mass is not a Benedict XVI prayer service. That's not what it is. Okay, even though it's not exactly the same, like St. Joseph's name mentioned in the canon of the Mass, okay, that was inserted in the 62 Missal and it was forbidden before that, that's, I don't agree with that, but do I believe that if, let's say, a priest were celebrating the traditional rite but decided to insert St. Joseph and you knew it, he was going to do that, would someone have to not go? I don't believe so, no. Okay, I believe that that's his problem, and it's an accidental part. It we're referring again to Benedict XVI. And so for these people to compare it to burning incense to idols, that is completely absurd. And another point that I think is important is that the false theology, which really promotes this idea that no one at all can go at all, and we agree in a lot of cases you shouldn't go, is that they start to equate these churches with non-Catholic churches. And in a previous conversation we discussed that, and I think we were discussing yesterday, and you really, I think, saw the point, that it's ridiculous to assert like that the traditional Mass you were going to is the equivalent of a Protestant church. That Catholic sense tells you that's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, there's no Protestantism at all.
Well, yeah, it's not a non-Catholic church.
No, they're
different from the Eastern Schismatic churches and the Protestant churches by the very fact that in the external forum, they publicly profess to hold all the papal dogmas and hold union with Rome. And see, like, what's interesting is, and in a lot of the papal decrees which talk about notorious, and at some point we might get into quoting some more of those because we have some more interesting decrees. In basically every case, it talks about that it's so clear that under no concealment whatsoever can it be excused in law. In other words, that a Protestant church is a notoriously is a notorious non-Catholic church because the pastor, the church itself, makes no pretense of communion with Rome. They say,
right.
Okay, absolutely.
They don't agree with the papal office. They don't agree with the sacraments, anything.
Right.
There's nothing.
And so they don't even try to conceal it. Okay, and you see that in a lot of the language of the traditional decrees as to what is absolutely notorious. It doesn't even make an attempt. It cannot be concealed in any way. That's used repeatedly, okay, in past decrees. And so that's the case. That's the difference with, like, an Eastern Rite church or, you know, one of these churches which professes union with Benedict XVI, is that they profess to hold the Catholic faith. They profess all the Catholic dogmas, whereas an Eastern schismatic church say they don't even conceal their rejection of the papacy. They'll say, no, we don't accept the Catholic teachings on the papacy. So that's the difference. But,
I follow you. I follow you 100%. I mean, matter of fact, Protestant churches go out of their way to say that they're not Catholic just by the name they put on the outside of it.
Yeah.
Episcopal or what, Methodist or whatever. They go out of their way to prove that they're not Catholic. It's almost like to say Catholic, or what we better know is known is the word which means universal. Catholic, all it means is universal. It's like a poison, or it's a sickness, or it's something that's evil. It's an evilness to Protestants.
Right.
You know, that's the way it is. I mean, they go out of their way to do that. That's you know, understandable. So, you know, it's just amazing that how people today will embrace the fact that, you know, with the ecumenism of, well, it doesn't really make a difference, or I don't really know. It's up to God who's going to die and all, whether they go to hell and things like that. It's just, and you know, it doesn't matter which religion you do. It's just sad. It's just a very sad situation.
And we would say that, I would say this. You know how I was saying earlier about how this Pope Galatius, he actually made every effort to urge the Latin-speaking bishops of Illyria to erase the schismatic Achaicus' name from their diptychs. That's like the equivalent of the Te Igitur prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that probably was occurring. It definitely was occurring over and over again in the early church, because you had schismatic patriarchs popping up repeatedly, as we've said in the past. You had, you know, emperors who would implant schismatics, or you had bishops who simply embraced heresies who were in control of particular areas. And so those bishops would have been removed from the diptychs. Well, did the popes ever decree that every single person at those churches must immediately stop going? Okay, I'm not aware of any vigilant decrees on that point. Okay, that's not saying that you could in every case go, but it's pointing out that this was not something. This is not something that's never come up before. This idea of a heretic being commemorated.
That's very good. That's very good. That makes me see differently. You know, something that I may have never saw before. That prayer. Even though what the prayer is I guess what you're trying to say to me, and what I should be thinking is that when Pope Pius V codified the Mass for us, that prayer was in there to prove the Catholic Church, to prove the Catholicity of the Church,
to show union with the Chair of Peter.
Absolutely, which makes it Catholic.
Right, and so that's the point of the prayer. The point of the prayer is not for Benedict XVI, or for any other individual. It's primarily a prayer to show union with the papacy.
Absolutely.
And it's accidentally, in the case of those who recognize Benedict XVI, a prayer for him because they falsely think he's the Pope.
Absolutely. I follow that,
yeah.
100%. And after the quote, he probably wouldn't even have to tell me about Pope Galatius, but now that you even told me about that, and that just makes it show that even though that it's significant, it's not that significant in as far as the true sacrifice of the Mass is concerned.
That's right. It's not, you know, the main purpose. The prayer is not even the main purpose to honor him.
I do know this. I asked Father Fattori, where I go to Mass, if he does include the Benedict XVI, and he said absolutely not.
Uh-huh.
He does not, you know, because he is Sede Vacantist, and he absolutely he doesn't. And you know, of course, we would never know because that prayer is whispered. That prayer, the congregation has no part of. That is between the priest, you know, and that's the Holy of the Holies right there at that point when he makes that prayer and he whispers that prayer. So, you know, I don't believe that he's going to lie to me about that because I've talked to him too long. I know for a fact he's Sadie Bacontis. But he told me for a fact that he does not mention, obviously there's, you know, not a bishop, so...
Can you hold on one second?
Yeah.
Okay.
Acquires true nobility. It despises the things of the world, unites itself gradually with God, and becomes spiritual and holy. Great is the efficacy of prayer, for it appeases God, attracts the angels, and torments the demons. Nothing can produce joy.
Okay. Yeah, well...
Anyway, the message has been delivered and message has been received.
Okay. Yeah, and one thing, example, which might help people, is that if obviously someone had an announcement, we're going to meet on this day and have a prayer service to pray for Benedict XVI as Pope, then the primary purpose of that whole gathering is to pray for him. That would certainly be a defiled gathering. But this is not the purpose of the gathering. It's to have the traditional Mass, and then the prayer, the primary purpose of that prayer where he's even mentioned, which is a minor part of the whole Mass, is to show communion with the chair of Peter, and the fact that he's mentioned is an accidental part of it due to their wrong belief. One of the things that's interesting about this issue that we've been talking about is that, like, it's pretty obvious to most people how apostasy kills souls, and how heresy kills souls, and how failure to accept the gospel itself kills souls. But a lot of people don't readily perceive, or it's not clear to them, how schism can kill souls. And with some of these issues that we've been discussing in certain individuals, we're seeing how schism actually works and how it kills souls, because individuals, through lack of charity and pride and failure to be reasonable, they actually go much further than is warranted, and they fall outside the church as a result and into these schismatic positions. And so it's an interesting illustration, and a sad one, as to how schism works, and that it's real, and it's actually working to the detriment of souls.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you made a couple good points and some things that opened up a lot of doors for me as far as my mind is that sometimes you have to just use common sense.
That's right, that's right.
You know what I mean? Sometimes you just have to resort to common sense and faith in God.
That's right, and that's what that article on jurisdiction shows, that when people start to try to take quotes from books and just apply them, okay, to our situation, it's really book knowledge gone awry, and it's really not much, because if they really understood the history of the church, they would see the fallacy of their arguments and their false applications. But something where you have to just be able to say, wait a second, they're saying that to go to all these churches is equivalent to going to a non-Catholic church. Is this the same thing as an Eastern Schismatic or Protestant church? No, it's not. It's a false argument right off the bat. People should be able to perceive that. There's a qualitative difference there between the two churches.
Yes, absolutely. There's no question I agree with you on that. Well, hey, listen, you know, as usual, you know, every time I, you know, speak with you, it's been a long time since I spoke with you. You know, there's always something good that comes from it. The end result is that I always feel better when I hang the phone up. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm glad, yeah, you asked some interesting questions, and I'm glad we, you know, were able to talk.
And then, you know, and then I learned some things, too, from that, and then, you know, hey, maybe that just makes you stronger in your beliefs, too, you know, in the long run, and the stronger in, you know, your, you know, apostolate. So, you know, it just works. It all works to the good. There's charity involved, so.
Yeah, okay.